Hello and welcome to a very special episode of The First 10 Pages. Why is this a very special episode? Because I'm finally doing a drama, like a real drama, and a big one. The Shawshank Redemption, one of our greatest films, and was underseen and undervalued and under everything. It did not do well in theaters when it was released in 1994. I don't know why. I know I went to see it in a virtually empty theater with my girlfriend at the time. We were shocked that nobody else was there. Let's put it in a little bit of perspective. Tim Robbins wasn't a big star necessarily, but he was somebody that I knew and I was a fan of. He was in the flop Howard the Duck. I vaguely remembered him from that. That was not a movie I enjoyed. That was not a movie anybody enjoyed. But some years later, I saw him in a film called Jacob's Ladder. If I recall, that is a thriller. It's been a very long time. He was also in Cadillac Man with Robin Williams. That film got a huge marketing push. I didn't go see it. I like Robin Williams, but I remember thinking, this one looked like a dud. And the reception from critics wasn't much better. He was in Jungle Fever, admittedly. I hadn't seen that either. I had not yet discovered my love for Spike Lee joints at that point. The first film that I got to know him from was The Player, the Robert Altman thriller that pokes fun at Hollywood and kind of pokes fun at thrillers. This was, for me, the film that opened me up to Robert Altman's work, and I became a big fan. The next film I knew Tim Robbins from was another one that nobody saw, sadly. A political satire, directed by Robbins, it was written by Robbins, called Bob Roberts. Nobody remembers this movie. It made a lot of noise when it came out. I recall it being pretty good. I don't know if I saw it in theaters, but I know I rented it at the very least, back when people used to do such things.
On VHS tapes.
Then came The Hudsucker Proxy, released toward the beginning of 1994, and this was not a Coen Brothers film that a lot of people went to see. I went to see it, and I freaking loved this movie. Made fun of the whole corporate overlord world. Just a sharp, smart, and weird film. And if you haven't seen The Hudsucker Proxy, there are things that are wrong with you that you need to fix. See that movie. Later that year, there was this little movie about a guy in prison, and it was called The Shawshank Redemption. It was called The Shawshank Redemption. Do we need to define the word redemption? Redemption is the act of saving, freeing, or regaining possession of something, often through payment or atonement. In its initial release, according to Wikipedia, it earned just $16 million against a $25 million budget. It had pretty good cast. People that a lot of folks didn't know then, but know now. These people include Tim Robbins, who was not yet a household name, Morgan Freeman, William Sadler, Clancy Brown, Gil Bellows, Bob Gunton, and James Whitmore. Writer-director Frank Darabont was not known for being a director at this point. What he had written had been some episodes of Tales from the Crypt, the HBO series, and the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. His only directing had been a TV movie starring Tim Matheson and Jennifer Jason Leigh and William Atherton called Buried Alive, a horror thriller. And he directed a short film entitled The Woman in the Room, which is based on a Stephen King story. Ooh, foreshadowing. So The Shawshank Redemption was his first big deal dramatic swing at a big deal epic feature. How did he make such a great looking movie? In part, it was because Tim Robbins forced him to use cinematographer Roger Deakins, who was mostly known at that point for his work with the Coen brothers. Barton Fink, Hudsucker Proxy, he also did Sid and Nancy, and a bunch of other stuff. And all of that brings us to the script. So what's coming, of course, next is the script read. If you haven't listened to my show, and there are so many fun episodes to listen to, you should listen to it. We do a script read of the first 10 pages. Why the first 10 pages? Because the rule of thumb is that you need to get a studio's attention, a reader's attention in those first 10 pages. If you don't get their attention in those first 10 pages, your script is doomed. We look at the first 10 pages, and what we look at is to see if the first 10 pages give readers, give audiences exactly what they need to know about the rest of the script. Everything someone reading your script should know about your movie should be in those first 10 pages. In these first 10 pages, there is a repeating direction in the action that you'll hear me saying. For example, fade to black, fifth title up, fade to black, sixth title up. That's kind of like a title over or on screen. And they occur in the script during Andy Dufresne's court case. What's happening in those moments is that the credits are running during the court case, but not when the court case is on screen. The screen fades to black, and then we get another credit. For example, you know, we'll go to black and it'll say executive produced by this person, that person, the other person. Back to the court case. And then we'll get a little bit of the court case, and we'll fade to black and get another title up, and during that it might say screenplay by Frank Darabont, directed by Frank Darabont, etc. So that's what title up means. And without much further ado, let's get to the script. Now, because I'm doing a very serious drama, I am not going to do a lot of funny voices for this script read. I know, in the episode where I read the script of Spotlight, I did do all the voices of the Peanuts gang. That's a totally different thing, and I regret it, and I will be sending an apology to everybody on Earth for that. But we're doing the Shawshank Redemption now. It is time I take things a little more. I'm just kidding. No, I do a lot of silly voices, and you're going to hear them. If you would like to skip the hilarious script read, go to 25 minutes, 40 seconds. Rita Hayworth and, but that's crossed out, so now it just reads, Shawshank Redemption. Screenplay by Frank Darabont from the novella by Stephen King. And it says, first draft with the letter P. That letter P stands for preliminary, by the way. So it's a very early version of this. On the next page, it reads, hope is a good thing, maybe the best of things, and no good thing ever dies. That quote, by the way, it looks like there may be an attribution there, or it might just be smudged ink, it's hard to tell, but it is a paraphrase from Stephen King's novella. I'm just not really sure why it's here, because this exact wording is in the movie itself.
Since the story takes place in 1946, or at least starts in 1946, I'm going to read the script in the voice of a newsreel narrator.
Interior bungalow, night. A dark, empty room. The door bursts open. A man and woman enter, drunk and giggling, horny as hell. No sooner is the door shut than they're all over each other, ripping at clothes, pawing at flesh, mouths locked together. He gropes for a lamp, tries to turn it on, knocks it over instead. Hell with it. He's got more urgent things to do, like getting her blouse open and his hands on her breasts. She arches, moaning, fumbling with his fly. He slams her against the wall, ripping her shirt. We hear fabric tear. He enters her right then and there, roughly, up against the wall. She cries out, hitting her head against the wall but not caring, grinding against him, clawing his back, shivering with the sense...
If only newsreels had this kind of description.
Grinding against him, clawing his back, shivering with the sensations running through her. He carries her across the room with her legs wrapped around him. They fall onto the bed. Camera pulls back, exiting through the window, traveling smoothly outside. Exterior, cabin night, to reveal the bungalow, remote in a wooded area. The lover's cries spilling into the night. And we drift down a wooded path, the sounds of rutting passion growing fainter, mingling now with the night sounds of crickets and hoot owls. And we begin to hear faint music in the woods, tinny and incongruous, and still we keep pulling back until a car is revealed, a 1946 Plymouth parked in a clearing. Interior Plymouth, night. Andy Dufresne, early 30s, wire-rim glasses, three-piece suit. Normally a respectable, solid citizen, hardly dangerous, perhaps even meek. But these circumstances are far from normal. He is disheveled, unshaven, and very drunk. A cigarette smolders in his mouth, his eyes flinty and hard, are riveted to the bungalow up the path. He can hear them fucking from here. He raises a bottle of bourbon and knocks it back. The radio plays softly, painfully romantic, taunting him.
Lyrics of a song that I do not recognize.
You stepped out of a dream. You are too wonderful to be what you seem.
He reaches for the glove compartment, opens it, pulls out an object wrapped in a rag. He lays it in his lap and unwraps it carefully, revealing a .38 revolver, oily, black, evil. He grabs a box of bullets, spills them everywhere, all over the seats and floor, clumsy. He picks bullets off his lap, loading them into the gun, one by one, methodical and grim. Six in the chamber. His gaze goes back to the bungalow. He shuts off the radio. Abrupt silence, except for the distant lover's moans. He takes another shot of bourbon courage, then opens the door and steps from the car. His wingtip shoes crunch on gravel. Loose bullets scatter to the ground. The bourbon bottle drops and shatters. He starts up the path, unsteady on his feet. The closer he gets, the louder the lovemaking becomes. Louder and more frenzied, the lovers are reaching a climax, their sounds of passion degenerating into rhythmic gasps and grunts. Woman O.S.
Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God!
Andy lurches to a stop, listening. The woman cries out in orgasm. The sound slams into Andy's brain like an ice pick. He shuts his eyes tightly, wishing the sound would stop. It finally does, dying away like a siren until all that's left is the shallow gasping and panting of post-coitus. We hear languorous laughter, moans of satisfaction. Woman O.S.
Oh, God, that's so good. You're the best I've ever had.
Andy just stands and listens, devastated. He doesn't look like much of a killer now. He's just a sad little man on a dirt path in the woods, tears streaming down his face, a loaded gun held loosely at his side, a pathetic figure, really. Fade to black. First, title up. Interior courtroom day. The jury listens like a gallery of mannequins on display, pale-faced and stupefied. D.A. O.S.
Mr. Dufresne, describe the confrontation you had with your wife the night she was murdered.
Andy Dufresne is on the witness stand, hands folded, suit and tie pressed, hair meticulously combed. He speaks in soft, measured tones. Andy.
It was very bitter. She said she was glad I knew, that she hated all the sneaking around. She said she wanted a divorce in Reno.
What was your response?
I told her I would not grant one.
D.A. refers to his notes.
I'll see you in hell before I see you in Reno. Those were the words you used, Mr. Dufresne, according to the testimony of your neighbors.
If they say so, I really don't remember. I was upset.
Fade to black. Second title up. D.A.
What happened after you and your wife argued?
She packed a bag and went to stay with Mr. Quentin.
Glenn Quentin, the golf pro at the Falmouth Hills Country Club. The man you had recently discovered was her lover.
Andy nods.
Did you follow her?
I went to a few bars first. Later, I decided to drive to Mr. Quentin's home and confront them. They weren't there, so I parked my car in the turnout and waited.
With what intention?
Not sure. I was confused, drunk. I think mostly I wanted to scare them.
You had a gun with you?
Yes, I did.
Fade to black. Third title up.
When they arrived, did you go up to the house and murder them?
No, I was sobering up. I realized she wasn't worth it. I decided to let her have her quickie divorce.
Quickie divorce indeed. A .38 caliber divorce wrapped in a hand towel to muffle the shots. Isn't that what you mean? And then you shot her lover.
I did not. I got back in the car and drove home to sleep it off. Along the way, I stopped and threw my gun into the Royal River. I feel I've been very clear on this point.
Yes, you have. Where I get hazy, though, is the part where the cleaning woman shows up the next morning and finds your wife and her lover in bed, riddled with 38 caliber bullets. Does that strike you as a fantastic coincidence, Mr. Dufresne? Or is it just me?
Andy, softly.
Yes, it does.
On that, sir, we are in accord.
Fade to black, fourth title up.
You claim you threw your gun into the Raw River before the murders took place. That's rather convenient.
It's the truth.
You remember it. Mincher's testimony. His men dragged that stretch of river for 3 days and nary a gun was found.
Yes, I remember.
So no comparison can be made between your gun and the bullets taken from the blood-stained corpses of the victims. That's also rather convenient, isn't it, Mr. Dufresne?
And a faint, bitter smile.
Since I am innocent of this crime, sir, I find it decidedly inconvenient the gun was never found.
Fade to black. Fifth title up.
The D.A. holds the jury spellbound with his closing summation.
D.A.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've heard all the evidence. You know all the facts. We have the accused at the scene of the crime. We have footprints, tire tracks, bullets scattered on the ground which bear his fingerprints. A broken bourbon bottle, likewise with fingerprints. Most of all, we have a beautiful young woman and her lover, lying dead in each other's arms. They had sinned, but was their crime so great as to merit a death sentence?
Gestures to Andy.
I suspect Mr. Dufresne carried out that sentence on the night of September 21st, this year of our Lord, 1946, by pumping 4 bullets into his wife and another 4 into Glenn Quinton. And while you think about that, think about this.
He picks up a revolver, spins the cylinder before their eyes.
A revolver holds 6 bullets, not 8. I submit to you this was not a hot-blooded crime of passion. That could at least be understood, if not condoned. No, this was revenge of a much more brutal and cold-blooded nature. Consider, 4 bullets per victim. Not 6 shots fired, but 8. That means he fired the gun empty. And then stopped to reload so he could shoot each of them again. An extra bullet per lover. Rot in the head.
A few jurors shiver.
I'm done talking. You people are all decent, God-fearing Christian folk. You know what to do.
Fade to black. Sixth title up. Interior jury room day. Camera tracks down a long table. Moving from one juror to the next, these decent, God-fearing Christians are chowing down on a nice fried chicken dinner provided them by the county, smacking greasy lips and gnawing cobbets of corn. Voice, O.S.
Guilty, 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 guilty.
We find the foreman at the head of the table sorting votes. Fade to black, seventh title up. Interior courtroom day.
The judge peers down at Andy from his dais. A carved frieze of blind Lady Justice on the wall behind him.
Judge.
You strike me as a particularly icy and remorseless man, Mr. Dufresne. It chills my blood just to look at you. By the power vested in me by the state of Maine, I hereby order you to serve 2 life sentences back to back, 1 for each of your victims. So be it.
He wraps his gavel as we fade to black, last title up. An iron barred door slides open with an enormous clang. A stark room waits beyond. Camera pushes through. 7 humorless men sit side by side at a long table. An empty chair faces them. We are now in interior Shawshank hearings room. Day. Red enters, removes his cap, and waits by his chair. The men pay him no attention, their busy pencils scribbling on forms. Man number 1. Sit. Red sits, tries not to slouch. The chair is uncomfortable. Man number 2.
We see by your file you've served 10 years of a life sentence.
Man number 3.
You feel you've been rehabilitated?
Red.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. I've learned my lesson. I can honestly say I'm a changed man. I'm no longer a danger to society. That's the God's honest truth. No doubt about it.
The men just stare at him. One stifles a yawn. Close up, a parole form. A big rubber stamp slams down. Rejected in red ink. Exterior, exercise yard. Shawshank prison, dusk. High stone walls topped with snaky concertina wire, set off at intervals by looming guard towers. Over 100 cons are in the yard, playing catch, shooting craps, jawing at each other, making deals, exercise period. Red emerges into fading daylight, slouches low-key through the activity, worn cap on his head, exchanging hellos and doing minor business. He's an important man here. Red, VO. Voiceover.
There's a con like me in every prison in America, I guess. I'm the guy who can get it for you. Cigarettes, a bag of reefer if you're partial, a bottle of brandy to celebrate your kid's high school graduation. Damn near anything, within reason.
He slips somebody a pack of smokes. Smooth sleight of hand.
Red.
Yes, sir. I'm a regular Sears and Roebuck.
2 short siren blasts issue from the main tower, drawing everybody's attention to the loading dock. The outer gate starts to swing open, revealing a gray prison bus outside.
So when Andy Dufresne came to me in 1949 and asked me to smuggle Rita Hayworth into the prison for him, I told him no problem. And it wasn't.
Con.
Fresh fish today.
Red is joined by Haywood, Skeet, Floyd, Jigger, Ernie, Snooze. Most cons crowd to the fence to gawk and jeer, but Red and his group mount the bleachers and settle in comfortably. Interior prison bus, dusk. Andy sits in back, wearing steel collar and chains. Red VO.
Andy came to Shawshank Prison in early 1947 for murdering his wife and the fella she was banging.
The bus lurches forward, rumbles through the gates. Andy gazes around, swallowed by prison walls.
Exterior, prison yard, dusk, tower guard.
All clear.
Guards approach the bus with carbines. The door jerks open. The new fish disembark, chained together, single file. Blinking sourly at their surroundings, Andy is the last. He stumbles against the man in front of him, almost drags him down. Byron Hadley, captain of the guard, slams his baton into Andy's back. Andy goes to his knees, gasping in pain. Jeers and shouts from the spectators.
There they are, boys. The human charm bracelet.
Haywood!
Never seen such a sorry-looking heap of maggot shit in my life.
Jigger.
Coming from you, Haywood, you being so pretty and all. Joe, taking best today, Red?
Red pulls a pad and pencil.
Bear Catholic, Pope, shit in the woods, smokes, or coin, better's choice.
Cigarettes, put me down for 2. Andy.
Whoa, wait 1 second. Andy? No, I think that's supposed to say Ernie. Yeah, that must be it.
High roller, who's your horse? That big gangly sack of shit, 3rd from the front, he'll be the first. Bullshit. I'll take that action.
Me too.
Other hands go up. Red jots the names. You got some smoke, son. Take my word.
You're so smart, you call it.
I say that chubby lard ass. Let's see. 5th from the front. Put me down for quarter deck.
That's 5 cigarettes on lard ass. Any takers?
More hands go up as the new prisoners are paraded along, forced by their chains to take tiny baby steps, flinching under the barrage of jeers and shouts. The old-timers are shaking the fence, trying to make the newcomers shit their pants. Some of the new fish shout back, but mostly they look terrified. Especially Andy. Red, voiceover.
I must admit, I didn't think much of Andy Dufresne. He might have been important on the outside, but here he was just a little turd in prison grays. Looked like a stiff breeze could blow him over. That was my first impression of the man.
Ernie, what say, Red?
Little fella on the end, definitely. And it take us.
Snooze. Rich bet. Red.
Come on, boys. Who's going to prove me wrong? Hands go up. Floyd, Skeet, Joe, Haywood. Four brave souls, 10 smokes apiece. That's it, gentlemen. This window's closed.
Red pockets his notepad. A voice comes over the PA speakers.
A voice amplified.
Return to your cell blocks for evening count.
Interior admitting area. Dusk. The new fish are marching in. Guards unlocked the shackles. The chains drop away, rattling to the stone floor. Hadley.
Eyes front.
Warden Samuel Norton strolls forth. A colorless man in a gray suit and a church pin in his lapel. He looks like he could piss ice water. He appraises the newcomers with flinty eyes.
And that is the end of page 10. So, let's talk differences. On screen, the film skips all the lascivious sex of Dufresne's wife and gets right to the car, him being drunk, grabbing the gun, all the stuff that you need to know about where Andy Dufresne is at the beginning of this movie. That's a really smart choice. It sets things up better, faster, smarter. We can see this is a desperate man, a man looking for vengeance, by how Robbins acts the scene. We don't need to see the sex in order to understand that. By Darabont getting us into that first line inside the court moments after the shot of the car, where we hear the DA say, "Mr. Dufresne, describe the confrontation you had with your wife the night she was murdered." Well, we get it now. If you weren't sure yet, now you're sure. And we're, what, 25 seconds in? We do cut to the affair briefly after she's mentioned, and then again a little bit later on in the courtroom scene when Dufresne is on the stand. That makes it seem to me, by the way, that these changes were done in the editing room, that the whole affair, sex, he takes her and she bangs her head and he puts himself... that was all shot, and Darabont was planning on showing it. It was probably in the editing suite that he and his editor went, maybe we should try this. What if we did this? What if we did that? That's usually how it goes, and it seems like that's how it went here, because they did have the footage. The courtroom scene itself is essentially the same, but more brief. A little brevity is always good in filmic storytelling. We see the gallery of the jury room more than we do the jury, which is an interesting choice. We never get that shot of the jury in the back eating fried chicken and Foreman calling out guilty. Aspects of that were taken from King's original story, by the way, so I understand why Darabont wanted to try and fit it in. He fits in a lot of things from the story, a lot of dialogue, a lot of actual word choices and phraseology. Red's visit to the parole board is essentially the same. But we get a bit more of him and his group of friends in the prison right after that and before the prison bus rolls in. You know, the prison bus that brings Dufresne. If you listen closely, you can hear where some edits were made to Freeman's voiceover. He's being cut off for expediency here and there. There's some chops made in the middle of his lines. Not as a bad thing. These are important changes. The most obvious change might be might be Red referring to Andy as a little fella in the script. Obviously, once tall, lanky Tim Robbins was cast, that line had to be changed, and it now became, "I'll take the tall drink of water." Yeah, that's a much better line. And that's where we are at the end of 10 pages, is that scene of Andy Dufresne coming into prison. But why do these differences matter? If you're looking at how the movie sets up its tone and style, pace, and approach, starting with the affair gives it a very different kind of tone. If you take the movie as it is on the page, it seems like a movie that is about the affair that the man was sent to prison because of. That's not what the movie's about. That's more or less our story, but that's not what The Shawshank Redemption is about. I mentioned earlier, before the script read, the contrast of cruelty with hope, a motif Spielberg later used in Schindler's List, by the way. And the reason you leave out the graphic sex scene is not because it's graphic. It's not because we don't want to see it. We all want to see it. It's so we can get to the meat of the story and our theme about hope in the face of hopelessness. And you can get to the cruelty, vengeance of the guy loading his gun in the car. Hope, the courtroomer Dufresne, is cool and calm and maybe even feels like he's proving his innocence by saying the line about the river, "It's inconvenient to me that you haven't found the gun." Contrasted with cruelty, the DA enjoying digging Dufresne deeper into his hole. With hope, cut to Red going before the parole board. With cruelty, cut to the new fish coming into the prison. With hope, a warden who introduces himself as a man of God with a cross lapel on his pin. Because the Bible is hope. Immediately followed by more cruelty, because the Bible. This is what the movie's actually about. Some of the shots that we get are very interesting. When we get to the prison, we do get this long, beautiful aerial shot. We get to see the front of the prison, and the camera goes over the yard, and we see everybody flocking to the gates where the bus is gonna let off the new fish. And we get a really good view of that entire prison. If you didn't know it was an epic yet, this shot lets you know that. When the camera moves across the gallery, all those people are very close to us. They're in a movie theater, they'd be looming over us, by the way. That's how that works. That's why it's great to see movies in a theater. Everything is a much more impactful experience. Not only are you trapped in a room, but everything kind of looms over you and it surrounds your whole world. And I think in these shots especially, that was kind of important. Kind of. Minus the kind of. But overall, what do we have? Does the script of The Shawshank Redemption tell us everything you need to know in 10 pages? Sort of. Kinda. I think the script giving us those first 2 pages, more or less 2 pages, of just raw animal sex sets up the wrong thing for the movie. There is some raw animal sex later on in the movie. We don't see it, but it happens. But this obviously consensual sex in the beginning of the movie, setting it up to such a degree, having it be such a production number, as it were, is a bit over the top for the movie we're about to see. It doesn't fit. It is why it was cut. It makes much more sense to go to Dufresne first and then cut to it once or twice during the courtroom just to give us the idea that, oh yeah, this was a serious affair and he has every reason to want vengeance. And I don't know about anyone else out there. I know when I saw it, it was very clear to us that this is a character who was innocent. There was never any doubt. I don't feel that Darabont was trying to make us wonder if he's innocent or guilty. He's trying to show us why people would assume he's guilty, but we, the audience, are in on the fact that he is innocent based on how his testimony is shot and how Tim Robbins acts it. One other thing I did want to talk about is Tim Robbins' performance, which I find very interesting. Part of the thing that gets his character sentenced is how cool and calm he is. The judge says to him that he seems remorseless. His character keeps himself bottled in. That bottle isn't uncorked until the warden refuses to hear him about this other prisoner who confessed to the murder of Tim Robbins' character's wife and her lover. That's the first time we see big emotion from the character. That, by the way, is a plot point in the script, and it's a turning point for the character. But okay, let's talk about other things about the film before we say bye-bye. It turns out that the movie Gilda appears in the film only by happenstance. There was another film that was going to be shown in that scene in the prison, but the film that was called for in the script that I can't recall the name of just now was too expensive. So the production went to Columbia and asked for a list of movies that they could use. When they came across Gilda, starring Rita Hayworth, they went for that one. Though Rita Hayworth almost wasn't in the movie at all, except for her poster. It made much more sense to choose a Rita Hayworth movie, giving us a little more context to why it had to be a Rita Hayworth poster. As mentioned earlier, while the film did not do so great in its initial run, it did rack up a whole lot of Academy Award nominations. According to Wikipedia, the most for any Stephen King film adaptation, which makes sense because there's a lot of those that ain't good. There's a lot of them that are classics, but there's a lot of them that ain't good. But let's look at this list. Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Cinematography, Best Film Editing, Best Sound, and Best Original Score. And now here's a fun little tidbit that I noticed. So during the movie, there is a moment where Andy Dufresne talks to Red about Mexico and the place he'd like to live by the Pacific, and Red says, and I quote, "That's just a shitty pipe dream." And it turns out that's exactly what it was. "Andy crawled to freedom through 500 yards of shit-smelling foulness I can't even imagine. Or maybe I just don't want to." And that's it. I'm out. Thanks for coming by. See you at the table read.
If you want to continue this conversation and follow me on the socials, I love talking movies, TV, and comic books at The Reality Comics on Blue Sky, which is like Twitter but not, and Instagram. That's both at The Reality Comics. Thank you so much for listening. See you at the table read.
The first 10 pages is written, hosted, and edited by Keith Planet. Music by Edison Carter. Any corrections, questions, or comments, please reach out via social media on Blue Sky or Instagram at The Reality Comics. The first 10 pages, copyright 2025.
Raw animal sex.